Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren by pointedly refusing to support conditioning military aid to the Zionist regime as a means to apply pressure on Palestinian rights. Polling from May 2021 by Data for Progress shows a clear majority of Americans and an overwhelming majority of Democrats support policies that would stop the Zionist regime's use of USAID to fund the seizure and destruction of Palestinian properties and to continue their annexation of Palestinian territory. Americans' growing reluctance to pay for the Zionist regime's apartheid likely explains why pro-Israel groups like Democratic Majority for Israel and American Israel Public Affairs Committee have ramped up their involvement in electoral politics, especially in Democratic primaries. Bhutto, who spoke with Intercept from Palestine, is not shocked by Biden's refusal to push Bennett to halt demolitions and settlement expansion. But she expressed a feeling of ongoing disbelief at the refusal of most Democratic politicians, including some progressives, to stand up for the Palestinian people. She told Intercept, "When it comes to demolitions, this is the part that I have never understood. I have worked with many of these families who have lived with the fear of demolition over their head. This is their life. These are their homes. This inflicts real trauma on kids. The fact that Israel's never confronted about this policy is really sick. Instead, we have candidates that come forward and just behave as though this is normal."
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Qasim Ali Himani and Sheikh Qasim. Assalamu alaikum to both of you and welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome back there.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Let's get to today's topic, which is the foundation of family in Islam. Why the religion of Islam emphasizes very much on establishing the family, taking the wife and having children, but inside the wedlock, which is the legitimate Shari'i system of thought, something which is unfortunately very much missed in the nowadays liberal capitalist lifestyle of the Western world. You know, just a simple look at the pictures and the lifestyle of the people, even in the U.S. before 60s, 50s, you could find such haya and modesty even in the clothing.
Exactly.
See? Yeah. But nowadays, you know, as naked as an animal. Is it so?
I'll allow Sheikh Qasim to answer that. Yes. But not just West, Brother Atta.
Yes.
You would see that attitude even in the East. You know, if you go back and look at the pictures of women in India 50 years ago.
Shrouded, yes.
Yeah, they would actually cover the head. Yes. They would actually pull their covering over the head so much further down that it literally covered their face, more like a niqab, right? Yes, yes. So the Hindu culture also had something called covering the head and covering the face to the extent of niqab.
Yes.
But then it's the exploitation of the Western culture.
The chastity.
Exactly. The so that led to the desanctifying the chastity of women and, you know, encouraging them to reveal more and cover less.
I think we've been talking about the philosophy or, you know, the underlying layers of this sort of actually deviation in the West and, as you said, even in the East. And again, I believe that that's you know, the way that they look at this world, and they are actually looking at the people like, you know, workers that are there in order for working for them. So
the
more they are committed, the less they work, you know.
Okay.
So I think that works to their interest in the best way by having, you know, or promoting ways of lives that have less commitment. So these sorts of relationships out of wedlock, I think,
just
serves
look at
them in the best way. Yeah.
Just look at the rate of the white trafficking. You know, white trafficking is a term used for trafficking of the women and girls from the eastern part of the world or from the Eastern Europe to the so-called North and West. You know, the thing is that they traffic human beings for the sexual
pleasure.
And
literally, they sell them. You know, I was watching one of these TED, you know,
talks. TED talks.
It was the former president of the United States, Jimmy Carter. He was talking about this, and he was giving the statistics of the people who are trafficked. You know, these women, as you said, the white women.
White trafficking.
And they are literally selling them to, you know, the casinos and, you know, these nightclubs and things like that. And it's, you know, it's happening now, you know, in the
and
real
they're
time.
Enslaved. They're enslaved.
Yeah.
They're not free there. When once they're sold, they're enslaved for their life.
And just look at the modeling life, the life of the models. There was also a documentary about the backstage of this model life, you know, the malnutritions that they have, different diseases that they have got. They are used,
like a product.
Sorry to say, as a tissue in my hand now. Yeah. One day beautiful, the other day ugly, taken out of the industry of the modeling and cinematic form. Yeah. Day by day get high and high and high, and they make a new movement out of that in order to put a seal on the main question, for example, Me Too movement.
Correct.
Okay? See, these movements might answer some of the needs or questions of the female or femininity, for example, the sameness of the wages of the payment in the West or in the US too. But still, it is a big seal on the main problems, and that is, is this really the position of a woman in a society?
In your society, particularly the Western society.
In the Western society. And look how much the feminist movement and the feminists look at the men. They're changing the man into the mother of the house and the woman as
the worker,
man of the world, okay?
Bread earner.
So, yes, this is the same problem we have, unfortunately. We have it. You know, let's get into the Islamic viewpoints and the make a balance of the role of the woman in the family and out of the family. Is it at all any role concern for a woman out of the family, for example, the society, Sheikh?
I think Islam has very clearly defined the roles of the father and the mother, or if you want to say it, man and the woman, in the society, in the house, in the family as an institution, and society as an institution. Imagine a society where you don't have any female gynecologists, right? So if you don't have any female gynecs, if you don't have any female doctors who are going to work into hospitals to deliver babies, what's going to happen to the Islamic system, right?
Oh.
So it clearly makes logical sense that Islam is not saying that, look, you're a woman, be at home, take care of children, and that's your job. No, Islam said, look, there are needs, and you need to prepare yourself to address those needs. So
that's
we need gynecs in the society, and they have to be women. You can't have male gynecs.
Okay.
You can't have male doctors who are going to deliver babies, right?
Okay.
So the space is open.
Yes.
However, Islam also puts certain restrictions where if the job can be done by a man and there is no need for a woman to enter into that field, Islam says, well, don't enter into that field.
Okay.
Enter into a field which is going to be beneficial for you and for the society and would help millions of other women who are struggling with a particular problem.
Yes.
So.
We got a program at the radio, Moments of Realization, especially the women and the ladies, were asked about the main reason and cause for the conversion to the religion of Islam. They say the respect that Islam has for the very personality of the women. This is exactly the Western women are looking for, respect.
Yeah.
Why not testing this way? I mean, hijab, covering yourself, and you know, not not the women are not limited to their bodies, you know, and the sexual attractions. Why not testing this way?
In this last Olympics, I remember that it was, I'm not sure which country
the German.
It was.
The German ladies, yeah, which covered their host from tip to toe.
Yeah, and
yes.
they were fined by the, you know, by the Olympics itself, or some organization that, why did you cover your body?
Yeah.
So you are there to be stripped, you know, out of your
exactly.
Clothes.
And the main reason, the coach answered that, we are not dolls. We are not sexual dolls. We want to cover ourselves from... And look at the latest law in the Senate of the France that they banned hijab for the women in the sport teams of the women ladies. Okay. You see,
in the country of freedom in the world,
democracy.
In the quotation marks,
it's not so-called democracy
and that's freedom of speech and all that stuff.
Okay, and where the world is going to get to with this manner? This is a question.
It's a very important and a fundamental question.
Yes.
That if we look at the world that the way it's progressing. I'm just voicing other scholars, you know, the Western scholars who have their point of view. What the Western scholar says is that you're making a mountain out of a mole. Why are you so worried, right? Look, they are getting into a contract. When I say a contract, a relationship, and they're going to have children, and they're going to upbring the children. They're going to take responsibility of the children. They're going to take responsibility of the wife, and the wife is doing the housework. She's cooking. She's upbringing the children. The only thing missing is the legality, which, according to Islam, is one of the fundamental requirements.
Yes.
So what the Western scholars and professors and researchers are saying, that the only element missing is the legality of the marriage. Apart from that, if you look at the whole institution, they are living just like any other married couple. So where's your problem?
Okay.
So, right? So let, I don't know. You guys can put in your view here to contradict them.
That there was a funny TV series recently aside. Whose father, whose mother is this?
Yeah.
And after so many, I've not
ever
seen.
And then the DNA test.
DNA test after so many years. And I say, okay, this is my mother. This is my father. Okay, let's have a big hug. I'm crying and shedding tears. Come on, man. Yeah. Is this a family?
I don't believe so, you know.
Children out of wedlock after so many years.
You know,
and
I
now
think...
with shedding tears, you know, this they are really the queen of dramas.
Yeah.
The dramatization of the saddest tragedies, the social tragedies and catastrophes of the society, in order to have it, you know, through a show. Would it be late night show, Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, Ellen DeGeneres, or no, the other guys, you know, through the DNA testing, Dr. Ozzy or something like that? You know, they are the queen of dramatization.
Yeah,
all the social problems, and the people believe them. This is the
You know, I think they have got to this understanding that they need the institution of family.
Really?
And they know that they have lost this too. Yeah, they have lost this too, you know, their strategies.
Okay.
So they are trying their best in order for reviving the institution of family.
Exactly.
And all those movies that we are actually watching, in the Western movies, they try their best in order for, you know, portraying a sort of a good family that is worth living in and things like that. But what I believe is that the underlying rules, the underlying Western understanding doesn't allow that to happen. You know, as I said, the ones that are controlling this system are not actually allowing the people that are actually soldiers or the workers or the slaves of this society,
sexual labor, they call it.
And you know, but those sexual labors that we talked about, there were some literal sexual laborers that were so open to detect, but many of these are covert actually and hidden social sexual actually workers that are working for these people, and these people are making money out of this problem, this chaos, this sexual chaos.
And see how much insurance, the insurance companies do not support, for example, underage pregnancy and abortion and death out of the abortion for the children, especially the ladies in the U.S. market, you know. And the catastrophe is this underage pregnancy in the U.S. and the rate of abortion, how much high is that, especially among the school girls, you know, there in the U.S., and in most of the cases, the sad news is that it will get into committing suicide.
Yeah, very true. Because they end up being sex workers.
Yes.
They end up being, you know, in working for pornography and yes, porn industry the porn and industry stuff like
or
that.
Something like that. But the case is that they know the problem, and we have some, you know, scholars, sociologists who are not even Muslim, living in a Muslim land. They say this is all because the chastity, the modesty, you know, the family foundation institution is
that
losing
is
its color.
That is built into women's, you know, nature.
Nature,
it's not
yes.
something
exactly. Yeah. Like Sheikh Qasim pointed yes. out, that, you know, they know that they need the family system and they're trying to revive it and yes. come back. So if you look at these women in the Western culture, the dating men, the changing men every 2 years or 3 years, you go to them and ask them that why are you doing that? They say, I'm looking for the right kind of a person to get married and settle. And that's what even when they're changing, they're looking for someone to settle down with for the rest of their life, right? So they know somewhere deep down that the only right solution is to get married, settle down, have children. So in that process, they were misguided.
Yes.
You know, there's something called conditioning of the subconscious mind.
Yes.
Media does that extensively, that the subconscious mind of the people are conditioned to behave in a particular way. And that's why even though they want the marriage system, they're not able to get to it because the subconscious mind is fighting against their desire for the marriage system.
Sometimes the marriage is the final step for a couple.
Exactly.
You know, they've got children. The woman is pregnant. After so many years, finally, they ask for marriage, and the woman is happy.
Exactly.
What when is this guy, happiness for?
Exactly.
I don't know. I don't understand.
So when
this.
The guy proposes, she's like on the seventh heaven. Why?
Okay.
If marriage is not that important, then why is it so important that the guy proposes to you and they want to get married and settle? So somewhere deep down in the fitrat, in the innate nature of the women, it is embedded that you have to settle down with someone in a wedlock, and that's the best.
For example, when you look at the Oscars, you know, an actor comes on the stage and says, I've been married to my wife for 40 years. I say, wow. See, this vow shows many things.
Yeah.
That the foundation of the family has lost really its colors in the U.S., especially among the so-called elites of the society.
Yeah.
Okay. So 40 years, 30 years, 25 years, this is a vow for them. and as Sheikh said, in the seventh heaven, when it's proposed for the marriage. Okay, the marriage, the foundation from the very beginning, it shows the husband showing your loyalty to the family and the children and being around and having a happy life and the prosperous life. Being away from the sins, the major ones, the minor ones, you know, bringing up good children in order to continue the path of the father and the mother in a society. And these are all the good things about having a family and establishing a family, especially according to the Islamic rulings, which I believe has the most beautiful rulings and rights for the women. And husband, both wives and, you know, husbands in a family foundation in Islam. Thank you very much, Sheikh Qasim. And Sheikh Qasim for your presence in the program Viewpoints. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. Also, a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in life, world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Almost 2 years after African-American George Floyd died beneath the knee of a white police officer on a street in Minneapolis, the police officers involved are being brought to account. A federal jury has found three former officers present at the scene of Floyd's arrest guilty of depriving the man of his civil rights. The jury found the conduct of the three officers led to Floyd's death, a charge that would impact the final verdict the officers will face. The three are convicted of failing to stop Derek Chauvin, who knelt on Floyd's neck for about 9 minutes, and denying Floyd's constitutional right to medical care while in custody. Tu Tao, Alexander Kwang, and Thomas Lane will remain free on bail until their hearings, which aren't scheduled yet. What's for certain is that they'll face several years in prison. Chauvin, the officer arresting Floyd, was sentenced to 22 and a half years last year. For Floyd's family, it's not enough.
This is just accountability. It can never be justice because I can never get George back. And no matter how many times that I pray at night and I think about my brother 24/7, it still is going to be hard, even though we just had a federal conviction and we already had the state conviction. But times, you know, will be probably a lot harder for me still because I can't get my brother back.
The trials are considered historic in the U.S., where officers are hardly ever indicted for the treatment of the members of the black community. Racism in the United States dates back as long as its history. African Americans have suffered tremendous atrocities at the hands of white slave owners over the years, and the impact it made on American society can be observed to this day. One of the early cases of police racism can be traced back to the early 1700s when South Carolina launched America's first law enforcement force, dubbed the Slave Patrol. As the title suggests, the patrols were tasked with hunting down black people and selling them into slavery. Following a devastating civil war, slavery in the U.S. was abolished in 1865, but the results the anti-slavery camp was looking for didn't come to pass. Wealthy plantation owners in the South found loopholes in the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and created what later became known as the Black Codes, the rules and regulations that appeared to have acknowledged the abolition but created the same slavery conditions in essence. Among the many racist provisions in the codes is the criminalization of vagrancy for black people. This meant that law enforcement was free to arrest and charge any black person who didn't have a job. The codes were a precursor to Jim Crow laws, which enforced racial segregation in the South and lasted until the mid-20th century. The recent killings and mistreatment of the black people are reminiscent of the lynching of African Americans and the destruction of their properties by the Ku Klux Klan and other hate groups throughout the years.
So I guess the main root is, you know, this country has been founded on a system of white supremacy, racism, and genocide. It's founded on a system of inequality. With a purpose, right? Racism with a purpose. The purpose is to create a group of second class citizens who the country can feed off of, right? We can feed off of their labor, we can feed off of their work, we can feed off of their existence.
U.S. President Joe Biden staked much of his presidency on a promise to fight racism in the country, managing to garner the support from a large portion of the African American society. But with many lawmakers balking at even the idea of police reforms, can the president make good on his pledge
you know, police reform and police brutality is a big issue for black and brown folks and for poor and working class folks here in the United States. But the U.S. politicians don't represent those people or those interests in this country. They represent a rich interest, the rich interest of the ruling class. And so, you know, they're not interested in police reform. So this bill, you know, essentially has died in the Senate and will probably never get passed because of the fact that, you know, there's no interest by U.S. policymakers to get it passed. There's no interest to do what the citizens want them to do.
George Floyd wasn't the first African-American who lost his life over what could otherwise be considered as an inconsequential offense for a white person, and certainly has not been the last. But the waves of scrutiny such cases bring up in their wake are indeed making a positive, albeit limited, impact.
Vienna's Palais Coburg Hotel, the venue of marathon talks between Iran and the P4+1 group. It has once again become the center of a lot of attention, as parties involved in the tough negotiations have signaled significant progress despite the complexity of some issues. The eighth round, which began on December 27th, has now become one of the longest rounds of talks between Iran and the P4+1, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany. Iran and the P4+1 are completing a draft text of an agreement to revive the 2015 deal. Most of the delegations acknowledge that the talks have reached a critical stage. The diplomacy seems to be approaching a make-or-break moment. Iran's lead negotiator says being near the finish line does not guarantee crossing it. Ali Bagheri-Kani says it requires extra caution, much perseverance, additional creativity, and a balanced approach to take the last step. The Iranian diplomat points out that to finish the job, there are certain decisions that the Western parties to the negotiations need to take.
Thus far, the West has been reluctant to make any sweeping political decisions that are necessary to bring the United States back into the plan. Iran isn't just going to forget the very many U.S. and Western provocations since the United States left the plan in 2018, and they understand that there are many political camps competing at once for power. The West needs to make sweeping political decisions that will definitively outline the future of U.S. involvement in the plan.
Iran says its initiatives pave the way for the progress in the negotiations and that a good deal is within reach in the Austrian capital. Tehran believes that the ball is now in the West's court, and if it shows serious determination, a good deal can emerge. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says Tehran seeks a lasting deal, not a fragile one. The president has noted that credible guarantees, putting an end to political claims and effective removal of sanctions are necessary for a lasting deal with the P4+1 group. But what are the characteristics of a lasting deal? The 2015 deal lasted a few years only. Even during the years that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was in place, Iran had serious grievances about its implementation by Western parties. It complained that it was not receiving the economic benefits it was entitled to. And Iran seems to have learned a lesson from how the hard-earned international agreement unraveled. Since the beginning of the talks in Vienna last year, Iran has insisted that America must remove all sanctions imposed on Tehran after former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out from the deal in May 2018 in a verifiable manner. It has also demanded that Washington provide guarantees that it will not leave the JCPOA again.
Iran wants credible guarantees from the United States because the U.S. has failed to provide any critical guarantees, any credible guarantees since the beginning of these negotiations. When the JCPOA was first being planned and negotiated back in 2015, the United States made a commitment to diplomacy and peace. Yet, in 2018, they proved that that commitment was not a guarantee by dropping out after the change of an administration. So what we find is that when Iran is talking to the United States and other Western nations that change their administrations often, and those administrations are subject to changing their positions from the last administration, then you find that Iran doesn't have any solid guarantees.
Iran says America's maximum pressure campaign has failed and its credibility has been seriously deterred. Observers believe Washington now has to take measures to compensate for its past mistakes and regain the trust of the international community.
The Israeli regime has carried out yet another attack on the Syrian capital Damascus's countryside, killing three soldiers. Syria's state television carried the report early on Thursday, specifying the assault as a missile attack. Various media outlets had earlier reported that Syria's air defenses had confronted an Israeli airstrike around Damascus. The official Syrian Arab news agency Sana said a number of explosions had rung out over the skies of the capital and its outskirts. This is the Israeli regime's fourth attack on the Syrian soil within the space of just 2 weeks.
They consider they have the military, the diplomatic edge, and really every solution for the Israelis is not peace, but it's a technical ability to dominate and control the Palestinians.
Just a day earlier, the Arab country said the regime had launched a missile attack on various targets on the outskirts of Syria's southwestern city of Quneitra near Syria's Tel Aviv-occupied Golan Heights. Last week, the occupying regime targeted areas surrounding Damascus and the western city of Homs.
Well, Israel pays no attention to international law. It doesn't even, I don't think, make a pretense of it. It violates international law every day in regard to the airspace of Lebanon, the airspace of Syria, the rights of the Palestinian people, and of course, in its threats against Iran.
Israel frequently targets military positions inside Syria, especially those of the resistance movement Hezbollah, which has played a key role in helping the Syrian army in its fight against the foreign-backed terrorists. Tel Aviv regime claims that its attacks target alleged supplies that are headed for the Lebanese resistance movement of Hezbollah. On countless occasions, though, the strikes have targeted reinforcement belonging to Syria's military and its allies. Tel Aviv mostly keeps quiet about its attacks on Syrian territories. Many view them as a knee-jerk reaction to the Syrian government's increasing success in confronting terrorism.
Is that Israel seeks to be the lone superpower, or you could say mini superpower, of the region as a junior partner of the big superpower, the United States. It wishes to be the dominant military force that actually exists as a country in the region. And I think that that's really what's going on here. It has nothing to do with international law, which is, as I said, Israel ignores.
Israel has been a key supporter of terrorist groups that have opposed the government of President Bashar al-Assad since the foreign-backed militancy erupted in Syria in March 2011.
Our position on the status of the Golan Heights is well known, and we would like to make it clear that this position has not changed. In line with international law and relevant Security Council resolutions, notably Resolution 242 and 497, we do not recognize Israel's sovereignty over the territories occupied by Israel since June 1967, including the Golan Heights, and we do not consider them to be part of the territory of the State of Israel. Annexations of territory by force is prohibited under international law.
Syria and the Israeli regime are technically at war due to the latter's continued occupation of the Golan. The Israeli regime maintains a significant military presence in the territory, which it uses as one of its launch pads for attacks against the Syrian soil.
Britain has sought to restore its influence and colonial rule in West Asia by pursuing aggressive and interventionist policies in the region. UK's first direct military involvement, the 21st century, began in Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks. UK officials beat the drums of war. Then Prime Minister Tony Blair, who was referred to as George W. Bush's poodle, played a key role in paving the way for UK's militarism. It has now emerged that British forces committed war crimes in Afghanistan. Documents show senior military officers buried evidence that British troops were executing detainees in Afghanistan. UK Special Forces officers killed unarmed Afghans who posed no threats. In 2003, London followed Washington's lead in accusing Iraq's former regime of possessing weapons of mass destruction.
So that was the UK's role, was to provide cover for the Americans. And of course, the Americans, the UK sees America as a means of getting a sort of protection, getting the big brother on their side, which they've, you know, following on from their experiences in 1945. The British establishment have a terrific fear of being left on their own to face a major continental enemy.
The UK, alongside the US, invaded Iraq without the UN mandate. British forces were primarily stationed in southern Iraq. British soldiers tortured hundreds of Iraqi detainees between 2003 and 2009. But no action was taken to hold the British government accountable for the war crimes that it committed there. Following the invasion of Iraq, an inquiry team was set up to investigate Britain's military intervention in the Arab nation. The Chilcot report said the UK chose to invade Iraq before peaceful options had been exhausted. It also said the former UK Premier, Blair, exaggerated the threat posed by Saddam Hussein. It also said that Blair ignored warnings on what would happen in Iraq after its invasion.
We have concluded that the UK chose to join the invasion of Iraq before the peaceful options for disarmament had been exhausted. Military action at that time was not a last resort.
London is one of Saudi Arabia's staunch supporters. UK-made weapons are used by the Saudi regime against the Yemeni people. The UK is one of Saudi Arabia's leading arms suppliers, along with the US. It is also a major supplier of arms to the United Arab Emirates, another country in the coalition that is bombing Yemen. The UK has continued to support airstrikes by Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners. It has provided both arms and ongoing maintenance and support, in spite of overwhelming evidence of repeated breaches of international humanitarian law by the coalition.
Well, its colonial interest is historical. I don't believe that anyone is trying to get Lawrence of Arabia back into the peninsula anymore. I don't think the British, even the most purblind British, don't think they can recreate the empire.
The UK-made equipment used in the war includes Typhoon and Tornado aircraft, Paveway bombs, and Brimstone and Storm Shadow missiles. The published value of UK arm licenses for export to the Saudi-led coalition since the bombing began in 2015, in March, is £8.4 billion. However, estimates showed that the real value of arms to Saudi Arabia is over £20 billion, while the value of sales to the coalition as a whole is over £22 billion.
Such hideous weaponry, and we are actually inviting oppressive regimes and dictatorships to come and buy this weaponry, knowing that it will be used against the people of Palestine, knowing it's going to be dropped on the heads of the people of Yemen, is appalling.
It is now believed that given the U.S. withdrawal from the West Asia region, or minimal presence, the U.K. is moving in to replace the U.S. while pursuing to restore its colonial influence and role in the West Asia region.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
James Dyke, Assistant Director of the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter, Southwest England, said it's hard to believe that Elsevier, a Dutch company that publishes research about the dangers of the climate and ecological crises, is the very same company that actively works with oil and gas companies to extract more fossil fuels, which drags us towards disaster. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Amy Westworld titled "Revealed: Leading Climate Research Publisher Helps Fuel Oil and Gas Drilling." Please stay with us to hear more about the story. The Guardian can reveal scientists working with one of the world's largest climate research publishers say they're increasingly alarmed that the company works with the fossil fuel industry to help increase oil and gas drilling. Elsevier, a Dutch company behind many renowned peer-reviewed scientific journals, including The Lancet and Global Environmental Change, is also one of the top publishers of books aimed at expanding fossil fuel production. For more than a decade, the company has supported the energy industry's efforts to optimize oil and gas extraction. It commissions authors, editors, and journal advisory board members who are employees at top oil firms. Elsevier also markets some of its research portals and data services directly to the oil and gas industry to help increase the odds of exploration success. Several former and current employees say that for the past year, dozens of workers have spoken out internally and at company-wide town halls to urge Elsevier to reconsider its relationship with the fossil fuel industry. A former Elsevier journal editor who agreed to speak on condition of anonymity said, "When I first started, I heard a lot about the company's climate commitments," adding, "Eventually, I just realized it was all marketing, which is really upsetting because Elsevier has published all the research. It needs to know exactly what to do if it wants to make a meaningful difference." What makes Elsevier ties to the fossil fuel industry particularly alarming to its critics is that it is one of the handful of companies that publish peer-reviewed climate research. Scientists and academics say they are concerned that Elsevier conflicting business interests risk undermining their work. Julia Steinberger, a social ecologist and ecological economist at Université de Lausanne, who has published studies in several Elsevier journals, said she was shocked to hear that the company took an active role in expanding fossil fuel extraction. She said Elsevier is the publisher of some of the most important journals in the environmental space, adding, "They cannot claim ignorance of the facts of climate change and the urgent necessity to move away from fossil fuels." She added, "Their business model seems to be to profit from publishing climate and energy science, while disregarding the most basic fact of climate action, the urgent need to move away from fossil fuels." Elsevier and its parent company, RELS, say they are committed to supporting the fossil fuel industry as it transitions towards clean energy. And while Elsevier has emerged as an industry leader with its own climate pledges, a spokesperson for the company said they're not prepared to draw a line between the transition away from fossil fuels and the expansion of oil and gas extraction. She voiced concern about publishers boycotting or canceling oil and gas firms. Marcia Bassiano, founding global head of corporate responsibility at RELS, told The Guardian, "We recognize that we are imperfect and we have to do more, but that shouldn't negate all of the amazing work we have done over the past 15 years. Of the more than 2,000 scholarly journals that Elsevier publishes, only 7 are specific to fossil fuel extraction. Those journals include Upstream Oil and Gas Technology, the editor-in-chief of which works for Shell, and Unconventional Resources, which is edited by a Chevron researcher. It also runs a subsidiary book publisher, Publishing, which includes titles such as The Shale Oil and Gas Handbook, and a strategic for optimizing petroleum exploration." Elsevier also provides consultancy services to corporate clients. For the past 12 years, it has marketed a tool called GeoFacets to fossil fuel companies. GeoFacets combines thousands of maps and studies to make it easier to find and access oil and gas reserves. In addition to locations for wind farms or carbon storage facilities, the company claims the tool cuts research time by 50% and helps identify riskier, more remote areas that had previously been inaccessible. However, top climate scientists, including those published in Elsevier's own journal, say just the opposite must happen in order to avert a climate catastrophe. Limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius or less requires a worldwide decrease in fossil fuel production, with more than 80% of all proven reserves left in the ground. Sherry Aldis, the deputy director for UN Department of Global Communication, said, "We will not comment on the practices of individual companies, but any actions actively supporting the expansion of fossil fuel development are indeed inconsistent with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals." RELS is an astoundingly profitable company with annual revenues topping $9.8 billion, about a third of which are brought in by Elsevier. Bassiano emphasizes that fossil fuel content represents less than 1% of Elsevier's publishing revenue, and less than half of GeoFacets' revenue, which itself represents only about 2% of Elsevier's earnings. RELS and Elsevier say the bulk of their work supports and enables an energy transition via publications centered on clean energy. Esra Erkal, executive vice president of communications at Elsevier, claimed, "We don't want to draw a binary, and we don't think you can just flip a switch, but we have been reducing our involvement with fossil fuel activities while increasing the amount of research we publish on climate and clean energy." Elsevier is not alone in navigating relationships with both climate researchers and fossil fuel executives. Multiple other publishers of peer-reviewed climate research have signed on to the UN Sustainable Development Goals Publishers Compact, while also partnering with the oil and gas industry in various ways. For example, the UK-based publisher Taylor & Francis signed a UN pledge and released its own net zero commitments, while also touting its publishing partnership with industry leader ExxonMobil, the oil company most linked to obstructionism on climate in the public conscientious. Another top climate publisher, Willy, also signed on to the Sustainability Compact while publishing multiple books and journals aimed at helping the industry find and drill for more oil and gas. Dr. Kimberly Nicholas, Associate Professor of Sustainability Science at Lund University in Sweden, said, "It's problematic," noting that while corporate greenwashing is rampant across multiple industries, the publishers of peer-reviewed climate research have a unique responsibility. She said, if the same publisher putting out the papers that show definitively we can't burn any more fossil fuels and stay within this carbon budget is also helping this fossil fuel industry do just that, what does that to do the whole premise of validity around the climate research? That is what's deeply concerning about these conflicts. Ben Franta, a researcher at Stanford University who has also published the studies in Elsevier journals, notes that the publisher's relationship with oil firms is indicative of just how entwined that industry is with so many other aspects of society. He said, this all happens without the broader public knowing and it operates to entrench the industry, adding, to effect a rapid replacement of fossil fuels, I believe these entanglements will need to be exposed and reformed. For its part, Elsevier emphasizes the role of editorial independence. Bassiano said, we wouldn't want to tell journal editors what they can and can't publish. However, such conflicts often place researchers in a tough position to navigate. James Dock, assistant director of the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter, was surprised that Elsevier would be working to contradict climate researchers in this way. He said, it's hard to believe that a company that publishes research about the dangers of the climate and ecological crises is the very same company that actively works with oil and gas companies to extract more fossil fuels, which drags us towards disaster.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the position of housing in Islamic culture. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of the position of housing in Islamic culture. We know that Islam says that if someone needs a house, it is necessary to him to have a house. And initially, in the early time in the Islam, we can see that whenever a couple used to marry, like a man or a woman, when they used to marry, the other people or the neighbors or the parents, they used to help them in making a house separately if they needed that. So the people, they were all helping each other, and they used to manage to make a house or build a house for this new couple. And therefore, Islam also emphasizes on such thing. On the other hand, we can see that in today's world, we have a lot of issues. For example, the people where they are hungry, they do not have anything to eat, they are facing the thirst, they are facing the, the being hunger, they are facing the hardship in their life. And on top of that, there is another issue, which is the rent. And they are forced, obviously, according to today's system, according to this capitalist system that we have today in this world. The people, they have to pay this rent in order to have a proper place to live, which shouldn't be this way, because it is the capitalist system. In the capitalism, the person who owns the house is earning through any means he wants, and there is no idea of charity or helping people or the social life. Therefore, people, general people, are suffering from such ideas. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the position of housing in Islamic culture. And we said that, unfortunately, in today's world, due to the system which is running the whole world, which is known as capitalism, due to that, people are suffering from the housing issues. They do not have house. They have to pay heavy rents. And on top of that, the houses are not according to their needs. So they are only getting the house which they can basically, they can pay off, or they can pay the rent, which they can pay its rent. That is the criteria of choosing a house in today's world. And it is not according to the needs of the person. So we need to look at the Islamic teachings, because Islamic teaching says that this house which you need to live, according to the Islamic teachings, where you can follow your religion, where you can have peace and happiness in your life, it should be in a way that it should be enough for you. And on top of that, it should have some place for you to enjoy your life. So therefore, when we look at the Islamic point of view of choosing a house, Islam emphasizes on this. But on the other hand, Islam also stops us from oppressing someone. So we need to help. We have infaq in the religion. We have this feeling of helping others in the religion. And the rewards are near Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So we need to help each other in order to provide a better house, a shelter for the others as well, inshallah. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.